Community Radio, because otherwise you wouldn't be hearing this message, and you haven't made your contribution yet, give what you can. If you are able to give $5 or $10, that at least contributes to the effort that we have. And this is really important to keep Community Radio alive in our community. Please make your contribution now. Just go to our website at weft.org. And now here is our episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with Joshua Evans, executive director of IARF, the Illinois Association of Rehabilitation Facilities. But first, disability news for the week of April 14th, 2025. In a cabinet meeting last week, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said that the agency is investigating the rise in prevalence of autism. Kennedy said, quote, "We have launched a massive testing and research effort that's going to involve hundreds of scientists from around the world. By September, we will know what has caused the autism epidemic and we'll be able to eliminate those exposures," end quote. In response, President Trump said, quote, "There will be no bigger news conference than that. If you can come up with that answer where you stop taking something, you stop eating something, or maybe it's a shot, but something's causing it," end quote. Experts have previously attributed the increase in autism prevalence to improved awareness, screening tools and methods, and changes in diagnostic criteria. According to Autism Speaks, quote, "There are many causes of autism. Research suggests that autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, develops from a combination of genetic influences and environmental influences, including social determinants," end quote. Kennedy, however, has spent many years supporting a link between autism and vaccines, despite numerous studies discrediting that theory. During his confirmation hearing to lead HHS, he did not disavow such views. Under Kennedy's leadership, HHS said that the CDC is planning a large study examining the connection between autism and vaccines. The agency has hired David Geyer, a vaccine skeptic, to lead the study. Geyer, who has been disciplined by the state of Maryland for practicing medicine without a license, and he and his father have also published papers claiming an association between vaccines and autism. In response, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network said in a statement, quote, "RFK Jr.'s comment is a clear signal that HHS intends to produce rigged and fraudulent research that supports Kennedy and Trump's pre-existing beliefs in a connection between autism and vaccines. It seems quite clear that he is forging ahead with rushing out misinformation to the public about the supposed causes of autism." Colin Killick, the nonprofit's executive director, said the proposed timeline is, quote, "far too fast for any genuine scientific research to be conducted," end quote. Americans depend on many foreign-born workers to help care for family members who are older, injured, or who have disabilities and are unable to care for themselves. About 6 million people receive personal care in their own home or group home, and about 2 million people use their services in a nursing home or other long-term care institution, according to the Congressional Budget Office analysis. Increasingly, the workers who provide that care are immigrants. The percentage of foreign-born workers rose 3 percentage points from 2007 to 2021 to about 18% of all workers, according to an analysis of census data by the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston. Foreign-born workers comprise about 18% of the overall workforce, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics data. They also account for a significant share of other direct care providers, more than 40% of home health aides, 28% of personal care workers, and 21% of nursing assistants were foreign-born back in 2022 when the survey was done. That workforce is in jeopardy amid an immigration crackdown President Donald Trump launched on his first day back in office. He signed executive orders that expanded the use of deportation without a court hearing, suspended refugee resettlements, and more recently ended humanitarian parole programs for nationals of Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. In invoking the Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelans and attempting to revoke legal permanent residency for others, the Trump administration has sparked fear that even those who have followed the nation's immigration rules could be targeted. Caregiving is often low-paying and physically demanding work that doesn't attract enough native-born Americans. The median pay range for is about $34,000 to $38,000 a year, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Listeners of this program have heard endlessly about the difficulties that agencies already have hiring reliable workers for these important yet underpaid positions. And finally, supporters of the Grace Foundation in New York celebrated placing 12,000 multicolored awareness ribbons on a vehicle last week, setting a Guinness World Record for the most ribbons ever placed on a van. The event, held on World Autism Day, brought together community members to raise awareness about autism and the importance of recognizing neurodiversity. On hand was a Guinness World Records adjudicator, Michael Emprick. He performed a spot check of the ribbon count before the event, inspected the van after completion, and presented the Grace Foundation with the official certificate, which is, by the way, their third breaking of a Guinness World Record. And that's the news for this week.
They said you're going in the Guinness Book of Records for what you did. The world is gonna see. They said you're going in the Guinness Book of Records. Your name is going down in history. One day we played Buffalera and they got a penalty. The ref said, put the ball in straight, but it was.
You are tuned to WEFT Champaign Urbana, and this is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today by Josh Evans, who is the president and CEO of IARF, the Illinois Association of Rehabilitation Facilities. Welcome to the program, Josh.
Hi, Vicki. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Why don't we start out by having you introduce yourself to the listeners and then talk a little bit about what IARF is.
Sure. So I'm Josh Evans, and I'm the president and CEO of IARF, the Illinois Association of Rehabilitation Facilities. And we have been a not-for-profit trade association since 1975. That was formed back in the 70s by what were then called vocational rehabilitation providers to advocate as a collective two-state government for funding to support providers that support children and adults with disabilities and to advance policy to ensure equitable and sustainable supports for people with developmental disabilities in Illinois.
And what is your background to have made you CEO and president of that group?
Well, I've been with the organization for about 20 years, and I started as what we call the legislative liaison in my early years, working with members of the General Assembly on behalf of our leadership and our board's policy directives, and I just essentially never left. So eventually, at the point when my predecessor retired from her role, people were looking around, and I was the guy that was elevated, thankfully, to the position I'm in right now. But primarily, I did a lot of the advocacy work with our state agencies and our General Assembly, and much of that work continues today.
So who are the members of IARF?
Sure. So there are hundreds of small and large non-for-profit mostly 501c3 organizations all around the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Organizations in the Champaign area you may be familiar with, like Developmental Services Center, Developmental Foundations, Inc., and similar organizations in the suburbs, in the city, and rural parts of the state, who were mission-based organizations that came together to recognize that individuals with developmental disabilities, both young and old, can access the community just like folks without disabilities with some targeted services and supports. And, you know, those can include operating group homes with staff to help individuals live as independently as possible in our communities. They include community day services, which are, you know, things like teaching activities of daily living to help adults with developmental disabilities work and recreate in the communities, and to help with on-job supports. Really, their goals is to ensure that healthy communities around the state of Illinois are accessible to persons with intellectual disabilities.
So your organization, would you say it's primarily a lobbying organization then?
Mostly, I would say education to our provider members by way of training for professional and paraprofessional staff, providing general education, you know, to the public. But there is a component and a significant one to our organization, which is advocacy to regulatory agencies, federally and stateside, but also to you know, members of our House of Representatives and our Senate in Illinois. It's 177 individuals, and you know, we see our role is to keep them up to speed on what's going on in services and supports, you know, what those challenges are that individuals and families and providers face, and to try to eliminate those challenges where possible.
And how did IARF get involved in the Dignity in Pay Act? I'm sure that there are some organizations that are members who maybe were paying subminimum wages in their workshops, or is that not true?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And so the landscape of employment opportunities, much like the services that we provide for people with disabilities, has changed and will continue to change and evolve from when largely states were institutional-based in terms of residential services to where we are now, to where the goals are to try to ensure integration opportunities for people as much as possible. And that's, you know, the case with how we collectively view employment opportunities, too. For many, many decades, and we actually have, I believe, service providers to thank for this. For many decades, a service provider was the one place where a parent or a sibling of a person with disability could look to try to create job opportunities, whether that is working in a facility alongside people without disabilities to, you know, do packaging work, organizing work, and other types of employment. That was really, you know, the only game in town, so to speak, for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But much like residential services in the disability space, more opportunities have been created in the community. Those would be private employers recognizing the value of hiring people with disabilities on their own, but also service provider staff going out and working with private businesses to say, hey, you know, I work with these adults or this adult that would really like to work in the community. This is this person's skill set. This is what they want to do. How can we make that happen? And so for many years, that predominant model, which, you know, you call sheltered work or facility-based employment, was, you know, the only game in town. But that's evolved over time to where there's a greater focus and recognition that persons with disabilities, if they so choose, should be able to work in the community. And so that, you know, that kind of brings us to, you know, the Dignity and Pay Act, which is what this legislation was called when it was put forward 2 years ago in the General Assembly.
Has it been 2 years?
Really, yes. It sometimes feels longer and shorter. I think, you know, since the pandemic, we all have a different, you know, sense of time.
We do.
But the effort actually started before the pandemic, as a matter of fact, with some advocacy groups that were, you know, pushing to phase out or eliminate 14C. And, you know, that effort largely failed before the pandemic. Not everybody was on board. Our organization and providers across the state had some very real concerns. And so, you know, from that point forward, we took a hard look internally to our organization and our members, and we had, you know, some very focused conversations. What would an environment look like in which we could phase out 14C? We came up with some recommendations. We shared those recommendations with the administration, Governor J.B. Pritzker's administration, and then we began to work with the administration and stakeholders towards the Dignity and Pay Act, which was signed into law on the 21st of January.
For some of our listeners who don't understand necessarily what 14C is, can you nutshell a definition for us?
It's a section in a federal statute regulation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. The ability to pay subminimum wage has been in federal law since 1938. And at intermittent points since then, Congress has looked at the allowance of the 14C certificate, which is basically a designation that a service provider can get in order to be able to pay subminimum wage. They've investigated it. There have been, you know, laws passed to try to, I think, curtail any abuses in 14C or use of 14C. And it's recognized, I believe, that while it does play a role and can in the greater employment spectrum, it's increasingly going away across the country. And it increasingly was going away here in Illinois as a result of the pandemic. And I actually believe that the total numbers of individuals nationwide that were being paid some minimum wage under a certificate dropped by like 86% since 2001. So there's that trend. That's organizations, that's states passing their own law or laws, that's organizations working to change their models. And so, you know, I guess from our perspective, the organization I work for, it's an issue that was a long time coming, and we needed to get to a place where we could support that, that we could ensure that the law recognized that there are still some challenges here that we face, and that more work can be done on those challenges.
Well, and there will be more work, I'm sure. This is going to be enacted over a period of years, correct? So
that is correct.
What are the steps that need to be taken to put this into full force?
I think what we'll see on or near July of this year, July of 2025, there is a statewide task force that is going to produce a report that includes a lot more data than may be readily available to the general public on subminimum wages, on different employment options, and on further recommendations that the state can pursue, potentially law change, potentially regulation change, and funding change to assist in the phase-out over the next 5 years of payment of subminimum wage. But paired with that, and this is what I think is what is especially important about dignity and pay beyond, which is essential, right, is the phase out of payment of subminimum wage, but is how are we growing opportunity? And I think that's what dignity and pay is really about, is shifting the focus on creating job opportunity for the disability population. Because as we know, unemployment for persons with disabilities is always higher than persons without disabilities. And this legislation recognizes that more can be done. So we'll see a report in July, and there will be annual reports after that to inform the General Assembly, our legislature, on our progress. And I have to say that the task force has done an incredible job to this point. We have to compliment Illinois' own Illinois Council on Developmental Disabilities, which has done an exceptional job of shepherding conversations over the last several months that have involved stakeholders, persons with disabilities, without, private businesses, state employees, employers all across the state.
Yeah, and you can't ignore the self-advocates who took a role in this bill as well. They had a strong, probably the strongest voice of anyone.
I would absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. And so what are the approaches that some of the providers may be taking here? I'm sure you've had discussions among your members. Are there organizations who are going to keep workshops, you know, the workshops as they were, but pay people, you know, minimum wage, or are they closing those? I know of, you know, a couple of providers who have eliminated sheltered work and are strictly using day programs, which means that people are still at an isolated, you know, program, but they're not getting paid anything now instead of just subminimum wage. Is that happening anywhere else, or am I just seeing a, you know, something rare that's happening near us?
I think that you're going to see a myriad of options that will continue, and I'll describe it as such. There are organizations that already have a facility-based employment model, which again is people with disabilities working alongside people without disabilities that are already paying at or above minimum wage for all employees, and demonstrate that it can be done effectively so that people can continue, if they want to choose to work there, they can do so and earn at least minimum wage. Mm-hmm. Those organizations have established those I'll call them models in advance of the passage of Dignity and Pay. And they're the ones that if other service providers are interested in pursuing those models, I think they'll kind of be subject matter experts for those organizations that, you know, may currently have facility-based employment. They can look to those organizations. How did you do this? You know, how did you negotiate contracts with private businesses to cover increased costs? You know, how do you make sure that, you know, employment opportunities remain available? And I think that could be the case going forward. And we have some of those organizations within our membership, and we know that, you know, they will happily share their knowledge and expertise with, you know, anybody that wants to receive it. And like you said, too, there are those that, you know, voluntarily, you know, prior to Dignity and Pay that worked away from keeping that 14C certificate and have completely converted towards trying to help people get jobs in the community. And I expect those efforts will continue with some best practice and knowledge sharing along the way. And the other thing, and I go back to what's important about this bill too, when it passed, is it recognized that, you know, like a lot of disability services here in Illinois, but across the country, you know, we're very reliant on government funding, on the Medicaid program, on some specialized grants from the state and from the federal government to support these efforts. And there is recognition in this bill that that effort doesn't just need to continue. It needs to be enhanced mm-hmm. so that we can see opportunities grow across all of our counties in rural and urban areas.
Absolutely. So was there increased funding for anything in this bill? Because I know that's kind of like let's not talk about more money. You know, they just don't want to spend that money necessarily at this point. But are there incentives for providers? And, you know, how does that work exactly? Or do we know that yet?
There are a couple of areas in it that stand out. And again, this is my position. I choose to think of them as sort of down payments that, you know, we're going to show you, provider community, that we're committed to growing employment and to doing it the right way, right? And mm-hmm. so there were two in there. And actually, one of them was a fund that had existed, and it's about $2 million for this current state budget year. The Department of Human Services may have gone out today, as a matter of fact, come to think of it, where there will be an opportunity for providers to apply from this pot of money of $2 million to support growth of community employment opportunities. So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And once we learn more about, you know, what the requirements are of that funding opportunity, we're going to make sure that we share that far and wide with organizations in the state. The other one is there were a couple of rates in our Department of Human Services that are intended to pay staff that work with people with disabilities to help them get jobs, called supported employment. Mm-hmm. There was a commitment in this bill to increase substantially, actually, by about 40%, I believe, two of those individual rates, right, in our waiver of funding for disability supports. And those are not insignificant commitments. And what I think is that when this report comes out in July, you may see further recommendations on funding changes as well.
You know, the one thing that worries me a little bit about this, and I love the fact that people are going to have an opportunity to work for at least minimum wage, if not more, mm-hmm. and to be working in community. My fear is that it will be only the people who don't need much support getting those jobs, because there's the shortage of support workers is just not there yet. So if you're going to be having people out in community, does that money, do those funds and so forth help hire more job coaches and people who can be on site with folks to make sure they're successful in their work?
I think I can certainly speak for IRF, and I think that's a goal of ours, mm-hmm. is to ensure that there's further investment in across the full range of government funding that supports persons with disabilities, and especially in gaining and obtaining employment. I can't speak for the governor, although this is an initiative of the governor, and I think Governor Pritzker has done an exceptional job in his tenure to try to build back our safety net and build back disability supports. But I believe, you know, that he and folks within his administration are committed to do this the right way, learn from other states, learn from mistakes we've made here in the past, to grow opportunity, not just for people that may only need minimal supports, but for people who may need more one-to-one supports to work in the community to grow that. And there are actually, you know, the bill, I could get into all the provisions probably by heart just because there was so much time spent on it. You know, there's recognition that we have an aging population that may have worked in facility-based employment for years, and that they, if they want to try to take a shot at working in the community, they need extra support. And the legislation speaks to that, and I think that was an important recognition that if you're going to provide opportunity, that you know, it's not just for persons that may need minimal support. You know, it's got to be for people that want to take a shot and work in the community that may need more support, and that was acknowledged in the bill.
Yeah, logistically, though, you know, the bill is passed. I think that's great. Who's going to be tracking all of this change that should be happening in the state over the course of the next few years?
There, so again, I mentioned that there will be a comprehensive recommendation report that's going to come out in July. But the legislation also requires, and I forgive me if I get the date wrong, Vicki, but I believe for several years after the initial report, there will be annual requirements that the administration must report to the General Assembly on progress towards implementing the Dignity and Pay Act. I don't think what anybody wanted was there to be a bill passed, a big hurrah, and then, you know,
and
people
nothing
go
happened,
off and,
yeah,
you know, and live their life. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in disability services and in mental health and elsewhere, there's been, you know, bunches of reports, task force that have been created with good intent that have created reports that sit on the shelf. And, you know, that may continue into the future. But I think just knowing the colleagues that I had a wonderful chance to work with on this bill, with the council, Access Living in Chicago, my own members, you know, there was a real commitment around the table to do this right. And, you know, I think that's why you have these annual commitments to keep the General Assembly up to speed, because, you know, this was a tough issue for legislators. You know, they were listening to families that were concerned back in their communities that this would take job opportunities away. And that was never the intent. And that remains not the intent, right, to take opportunity away. And we needed to make sure that there was a commitment to keep them informed.
And I don't think that's unusual for parents, you know, especially older parents whose children who have been in those workshops for their whole lives. And, you know, the change is difficult for a person with a
very
disability
difficult
oftentimes. So they're having to adjust to that as well. But I think I've heard so many success stories from other states about how the getting a real job has made a world of difference for each and every person that's had an opportunity to do it. So I appreciate your effort. I congratulate the entire team on the Dignity and Pay Act. And it seems to me just a first step in many steps to improve the lives of people with disabilities in our state.
Indeed. Much work remains.
Yes. So thank you very much, Joshua Evans, President and CEO of IARF, the Illinois Association of Rehabilitation Facilities. We appreciate your efforts. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
No, I'll stay. Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and SunPower by Legacy Solar. Based in Towanda, Illinois, a proud supporter of